Hello, diners and travelers of the world. Here we are again, Ann and Peter Haig, bringing our latest interviews to you with On the Menu, onthemenuradio.com. Today, we have what we're calling mixed beverages.
Yeah, actually, it's probably even snappier to say mixed drinks, but they're mixed drinks of a somewhat unusual kind because a couple of them are alcoholic, but one of them is not really. So, but we're starting off with a good old American alcoholic beverage called bourbon whiskey, and Lincoln Henderson.
Who
we caught up with when he was on his way to Pennsylvania to plug his Angel's Envy bourbon, and he explains why it's as special as it is.
So it's good.
It is good, yeah. And let's hear what Lincoln, how it got to be that way, shall we say.
Right.
A few weeks ago, we spoke with Julian Van Winkle, the third or fourth or whatever it is, about how he got into the family business making whiskey. And he said, well, it was really kind of simple. I sort of inherited it. Now we have another take on the whole thing. Lincoln Henderson from Angel's Envy got into the business for a different reason. Tell us about it, Lincoln.
Well, actually, I got into the business after I graduated from the University of Louisville with a degree in chemistry. I needed a job and started looking around, and the job was opening at Brown-Forman in Louisville, Kentucky as a grain chemist. So I took the job, and I was there for 39-plus years.
That's a long time.
So I started out as a grain chemist, studied as a distillery production manager, and then went on into taking over the sensory evaluation for all the whiskeys that Brown-Forman had and the wines and the liqueurs, whatever. And I'm saying this because it was a small company at that time. A lot of us had to do multiple jobs and then progressed on up into becoming the director of whiskey development and maturation. And at that time, I was named the master distiller for Brown-Forman, which included all the distilleries.
Just mention a few of the top names that you worked with.
Well, actually, the whiskey that I adopted when I came to Brown-Forman was Old Forester, which was the original whiskey from 1870. And the Brown family, who I became very close friends with, or primarily the owners of the company, said that, Lincoln, whatever you do, you can change anything else, any other whiskeys, but do not change Old Forester. So that was my baby. And then
that was my mother's favorite, yeah, her generation.
It's one of the finest, I think it's still one of the finest bourbons in the market. And then we bought the company Canadian Mist and Southern Comfort. And then Jack Daniel's was bought in 1956, involved with Jack Daniel's and Canadian Mist and Southern Comfort. And then my last thing at Brown-Forman was to develop a whiskey called Woodford Reserve.
Which we love also.
Yes, which was the whole project started in 1992, and I was involved with the restoration of the old distillery from 1992 to 1996 when we started bottling Woodford Reserve. And it's the only relatively large distillery operation which uses strictly pot stills. And what we tried to do there was to go back to the 1700s and do a whiskey that was in that style. So it did become very successful, and it's very successful today. So that's basically what I did over the 39, 40 years.
Well, I actually meant you to tell us about your latest adventure, but obviously you're very well qualified, but then you retired.
I retired.
In fact, you retired twice.
And yeah.
Let's miss out the Japanese single malt whiskey episode just in the interest of time, because we're talking about Angel's today, and Angel's, the brand, came into existence for a entirely different reason.
Well, actually, my son, while I was working for Suntory International with their single malt whiskeys, kept bugging me about starting a distillery company. And since I was involved with it my whole life, and he knew a lot about it, so finally he did, and the result of 6 years of hard work on my son's part and relatively little work on my part, because I had the easiest part in making whiskey. That's so simple. And anyway, he got the investors together, and they actually came up with a name, Angel's Envy.
Which is, explain that. That's
okay. In the whiskey business, whether you make whiskey in the United States or in Japan or in Europe or wherever, you have to guarantee that the angels get a certain share of that whiskey. Because if you don't, the whiskey's not going to turn out very well.
That's really a fairy story. guys.
Oh no.
Listeners, it naturally evaporates and goes up the chimney. Come on, Lincoln.
Oh, no, we don't have chimneys in our warehouse.
We don't have chimneys. Okay.
If you go into the warehouses in the night and start sampling barrels, you always feel like somebody's watching you. and then that's really, we feel like that the angels are there. They're not the angels that you expect. They're not the really ones you expect in the church and stuff. But so what we do is we have a way to keep the best share for us, and they still get enough. And the name came from that. The angels envy. They envy what we still have. It's a matter of fact, though, that any whiskey maturing in a barrel, you're going to lose anywhere from 3 to 5% of that whiskey a year. And we call that the angels. So we think that's too much for them.
Now, there's something very unusual about angels' envy. Certainly, as far as I'm concerned, I've heard of a number of Scotch whiskey distilleries in Scotland using barrels from different kinds of spirits.
Yes.
I always thought that bourbon whiskey had been made in new barrels, but you're proving that that's not correct.
Oh, no, that is true. What we do is we contracted with some of my friends in the business to make whiskey for us according to my specifications to make bourbon whiskey. And then this was actually about five years ago. So we made the bourbon. We matured the whiskey in new charred white oak barrels, and it became bourbon. Then we took it out of the barrels and put it in port barrels that we ordered from Portugal.
Oh, okay. So as long as you originally make it,
that's right,
in new barrels, it's okay to call it bourbon. But then for subsequent aging, you can use anything else?
Yes, but you can't call it. You can't take age on it. You can just say that it's finished in. Stored in X type of barrel. Fortunately, I had a lot of leeway when I was working on the Woodford project to experiment. Before I left Brown-Forman, and I ordered a whole bunch of different types of barrels, port barrels, sherry barrels, premium tequila barrels, premium rum barrels, brandy barrels, and I experimented with those barrels. But Brown-Forman decided not to go in that direction, so when my son said, what can we do to make this whiskey, this bourbon whiskey special, and I said, well, shoot, let's just put it in some port barrels. And so he ordered the port barrels from Portugal. They were beautiful port wine barrels that had ruby port in them, which is, we asked for that because that's one of the lightest ports. We didn't want the port to override the bourbon. So we put the bourbon in the port barrels and left it in there for, I would thought of maybe 3 months would be sufficient, but it actually took us about 6 months to get where we are today with Angel's Envy.
Okay, so you were doing like book or no. You were testing a little bit every day to see how it was coming along?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what you have to do.
What a terrible job. Somebody has to do it, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Lincoln, I mean, let's specify that this is small batch artisanal bourbon. I mean, just make sure that's right up front.
Yes.
And you have very, very high standards, including using locally sourced, non-genetically modified grains, Kentucky limestone water, which sure ties it to a terroir here.
Oh, yeah.
And hand-chosen port barrels.
Yeah.
Okay. And also the bottling is rather extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes. In fact, our partners were responsible for that because one of our partners, they were involved, actually started one of the leading advertising and marketing companies in the world. These guys took off and started developing the bottle and the name. And when I first saw the name and the bottle, I thought, this is crazy. This is not a bourbon bottle. But that was my opinion because I've worked in the business so long and it should either be round or square.
Uh-huh.
But it turned out really great, and now it just really fits the profile for Angel's Envy.
Each bottle's hand-filled, corked, and crated in Louisville.
That's right.
So this is very special stuff.
I can just picture you carefully pouring the bourbon into the barrel yourself.
Well, with a teaspoon, actually. Yeah, it takes a while.
Well, this is a fascinating story, and people from just a very few states are going to be fortunate enough to get some. Our home state of Pennsylvania is going to be one of those. And which are the others?
We're in California now, and before that we did Florida. Kentucky was first. And then we did Texas, and then we did Florida, and then California, and then Pennsylvania. and Chicago. Pennsylvania was a very special thing for us because Pennsylvania, you can't just go in there and work with a distributor. I mean,
oh yeah, we know that.
That's go through the state, but we were so well treated when I went up there last year, actually, and I was scared to death because I heard about the difficult, you know, some of the horror stories of getting into Pennsylvania. But this young gentleman that was in charge of taking on new spirits was wonderful, and he looked at the bottle, we tasted it, and he says, I think we can do this. And so then he asked us if we'd like to be in the Philadelphia whiskey event the next week or so, and then the one in Pittsburgh. Uh-huh. And we said, well, sure. And so we're there, and we're so happy.
We're delighted. It's going to be in short supply, premium priced, but obviously in Pennsylvania, you know where you have to go buy it. Whether you have a choice or not, it's going to be in the superstores, the super specialty stores only, I think.
Yes.
In other states, I'm sure you can find it through your local liquor purveyor. Is there actually a supplier list on your website?
Yes, there is.
Great.
It's Louisville Distilling or Angel's Envy, I think.
That's it. It's Angel's. It's www.angelsplenvy.com. That's it. I'm just reading it now.
So if you're looking for some sipping whiskey, new, but in a way it's really very old, Angel's Envy's for you. You sent us a sample. We
cleared that off pretty fast.
We disposed of it the first evening. It is really quite delicious.
It's a very small sample.
Yeah.
Didn't make it sound like we drank a whole bottle.
No, we had read about it in, I think it was Esquire magazine, where it was very highly rated. It has the on-the-menu seal of approval. And Lincoln, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure the supply is going to increase gradually, so
yes,
more and more people will be able to enjoy not the Angel share, but the what's left behind.
Yes, well, Ann and Peter, I thank you so much.
And now it's time to take a break. I'd sneak away and have a nip of Angel's Envy if there was any.
We didn't have any.
There was any left, but there wasn't because it was good. Anyway, let's take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up, an exciting new beverage called Ice Cider, never tasted before.
No, I never even knew it existed. And you get a clue, of course, because those of you who are sophisticated will know that cider indicates that the juice that's used to make this is from apples. But who knew you could make, well, I guess I always knew you could make crab apple wine and things like that, but an ice cider, cider that's like ice wine. I never even heard of it before. We came across a wonderful couple called Leger, who are from the border of Vermont and
he's French Canadian.
Quebec, and a tradition that we also thought must go back for centuries, but it turns out it only goes back about 20 years. So it's a really altogether a fascinating story about ice cider.
You know, I never knew there was such a thing as ice cider.
Well, there are lots of things in this world that you don't know.
I know, which is why I love this job. I get to learn all these different things. We're talking to Albert and Eleanor Leger, who are not in Canada, but they are in Vermont. And they're making ice cider called Eden, is the company name, Eden Ice Cider, from apples. Welcome to On the Menu. And I'm going to start off by asking you, whatever gave you this idea, is it a common thing in Vermont?
Well, ice cider was developed in Quebec, which is right across the border from us. And in fact, where we are, we're only about 10 miles from the border. So within a couple hours drive, there are a number of ice cider makers in Quebec. But we will freely tell you, we stole the idea. And we're the first ones to really do it in a big way here in Vermont.
Huh. Now, you say you're doing it in a big way.
Well, size is always a relative term.
Sure.
We certainly started extremely small. We made 100 cases our first year, and we're up to about 1,500 cases now.
That's quite a lot of ice cider.
Yes, especially since you drink a little bit at a time.
Now, it's sort of like a specialty niche, is it?
Yes.
I mean, it's a tradition in Quebec that you just make this because I guess you have apples.
Correct. Quebec, and just like New England, used to be the heart of the apple industry for North America. And, of course, that's all moved to the West Coast and to other countries. So the apple orchards here are really looking for value-added products that they can use to help them survive.
Okay, so sort of an experiment in survival for apple growers.
Yes, I think they looked at Ontario and saw the success of the ice wines from grapes in that region.
Okay.
And thought, couldn't we do something similar with all of our apples?
Now, is that how the Quebec was? Is that how they started it?
Yes, about 20 years ago.
Okay, so it's not like a five-century tradition.
No, not at all.
Now, I was wondering, since Canada was founded a very long time ago, now whether it was a sort of a French colonial thing happening in French colonial Canada.
But Alvera's relatives were here at the time, but as far as we know, there's no family tradition.
Okay, all right.
I thought immediately of Brittany. Isn't that where they make the... Where do they make the...
Normandy.
Normandy,
I guess.
Normandy is where they make the...
They grow apples and they make Calvados.
Oh, yes.
Normandy.
Yes, that's distilled, however. Our ice cider is like a wine. It's fermented.
Why don't you just run us through this process? Because I found it fascinating.
It is very much a vintage winemaking process, but the thing that really sets it apart is the cold concentration. So if you just press an apple, the sugar level, particularly for most dessert apples, tends to be around 11, 12, 13%. And to make a real wine, you need more than that. And if you're making a sweet wine, you need even more. And so the process is really, we press late variety apples, and we start pressing in November and go through December. And starting around November here in northern Vermont, it's reliably below freezing. So we press the apples and put the cider right outside in large plastic containers that can handle the expansion as it freezes. And as the water in the juice freezes, what hasn't yet frozen gets denser and denser with the sugar level, and that lowers the freezing point. So Albert can explain this even better because he's a chemist.
Oh.
We drop a probe into the middle, and at 22 degrees Fahrenheit, it's concentrated to 35% sugar, and it's still liquid. And that's what we drain off and ferment. So we lose about 75 to 80% of the volume of juice that we started with, which is just frozen as ice, and the remaining concentrate is what we ferment. And then, of course, to keep the sweetness in the wine, we have to stop the fermentation partially as it's halfway through. Our products are about 10 to 11% alcohol and about 15% residual sugar, and we stop the fermentation by putting it right back outside because it's still very cold in March when the fermentation is ending, and that kills the yeast. They fall to the bottom of the tank, and we just rack off from there.
So during the time when you're actually doing the freezing, you're actually picking lumps of ice out of the cider tank.
Actually, the ice just stays behind. There's a valve at the bottom of these big plastic cubes that we use.
Oh, okay, all right.
So they're frozen outside. We bring them back into our garage and open the valve, and the sugary liquid, which has all the flavors, all the soul of the apple, we call it, that comes out, and the ice, the water, stays back. It's a big block of ice that just doesn't melt.
Okay.
And what do you do with that?
Eventually it melts.
In the spring.
Yeah, there's nothing much to do with it. It's just slightly sugary liquid.
I see.
Yeah, so it just sort of runs away, huh?
Yeah.
Now, you sent us three different bottles, very handsome bottles, I might add.
Thank you.
Now, two of them looked like they were identical, but I'm sure they weren't. And they were the true ice cider.
Correct. Right. The Calville Blend is our largest volume product, and it is made with a blend of 11 different varieties of apples, and that includes a lot of heirloom and cider variety apples that you would never find in a grocery store, and we could talk about some of those. The second one is a single varietal ice cider made just from Northern Spy apples, which is
okay.
A classic New England
right.
baking apple. Has a great balance of sugar and acidity on its own, and then we put that in a French oak barrel for a year, so the oak gives it more complexity than it would have on its own.
Oh, I see. Okay, all right. So if you like, that's a more expensive, a more exclusive kind of product.
Correct, and we only made 100 cases of that this year.
Okay,
oh, wow.
Well, I'm glad we contributed to the consumption of it.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you have another product which is much drier, called Orléans.
We pronounce it Orléans because Orléans is the county that we're in Vermont. We're also, our town is right next to the town of Orléans, Vermont, and we also love New Orleans, and this is this aperitif cider, which is much drier and also infused with herbs, is something that is a great mixer for cocktails. And we think of New Orleans as being a great cocktail center.
Well, we went to the museum.
And it also refers to our combined French-American heritage.
Yeah, we went to the Museum of American Cocktail in New Orleans.
Yes. There's a big cocktail festival in New Orleans. We hope someday to go. But the Orleans Aperitif Cider is a collaboration between us and Deirdre Heekin, who is the author of a book called Libation, which is about Italian Amari and making infusions. And she came and helped us develop the recipe. So one of the things that we decided as we went through that process is that the recipe should be made of things that we could grow here in Vermont, so that it's still very true to who we are in our terroir. So there is basil in it, and there's also a slight anise component to it, and that comes from anise hyssop. Hyssop is a common herb that's up here, and the anise variety of it gives it that taste.
Yeah, we had one of those in it. Somebody killed it, I think.
We had a hyssop plant. It flourished for 2 or 3 years, and then it just didn't come back. The birds used to love it.
Yeah.
We had these birds. They were, I think they were finches.
Yellow finches.
But we called them
hyssop warblers.
We called them hyssop warblers. and they were really quite remarkable, because their plumage changed color with the season, along with the hyssop plant. So I'm sorry we don't have the hyssop anymore, but it was kind of a nuisance because it took up a lot of room.
Now, we know what Albert did. He's a chemist. Eleanor, what did you do before you made cider?
Oh, I spent a 20-year career in financial services and software.
Oh, wow.
Oh, just the kind of preparation you need for making
wine. I became a good appreciator of wines and wanted to figure out how we could make something that would be true to where we are and who we are. So while there are some very interesting cold hardy hybrid grapes that are being grown in Vermont now, we wanted to find something that would really, where you could believe that the best in the world could come from here. And so we've got a centuries long tradition of growing apples in Vermont and lots of cold weather to be able to do it.
Well, you grow
naturally without using artificial refrigeration.
Yeah, well, you grow just about everything in Vermont. I mean, and change careers. And when we've talked to people, there's a woman raising goats in Vermont who is a Manhattan literary agent.
Yes, that's considered Bardwell Farm.
Yes, exactly.
Yes,
we've interviewed her. She's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we interviewed cheese people, fudge people, chocolate people. I mean, just everybody's up in Vermont.
Well, the neat part about the cheese is, of course, it's a perfect pairing with these wines.
Exactly. Thank you for pointing that out.
Well, you did send us a clue with a few with a few restaurant menus where cider was featured. So if people are wondering, well, what would I do with that? That's the answer. The answer is you do it with dessert, or you use the Orleans in a cocktail mixer. It goes very well with vodka. I didn't try with gin. I suspect it would probably go very well with gin.
Some gins better than others. We think Hendrick's is fabulous, and there's a Green Mountain organic gin here that does very well as well.
Okay.
The other favorite, the cold something?
Cold River is from
Maine.
It's from Maine.
Maine.
You ought to look up those up, though. Cold River vodka and Cold River gin.
Yes, fabulous. I do have a bottle of their gin.
You do.
Beautiful, isn't it?
I would have thought that would do well.
Yes.
So we're thinking of lots and lots of things we can do with this rather unusual product. And the most amazing thing, and thank you for being very straightforward with us about it, is we thought this was a sort of a long-time traditional thing, and it's really not. It's a sort of a modern invention and a very clever one, and we wish you a great deal of success with it.
Thank you so much.
Oh, yes, yes.
How do you get it is the next
question.
That's
a good question.
So we have distribution in Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, New York, and California. And on our website, you can find locations in those states. Even if you're not near one of the stores, I'm sure they'd be happy to find a way to get it to you. And then in some of the other states where it's legal, we can ship.
Okay, so you do Internet sales.
Right, we don't have e-commerce on the website because the alcohol laws are complicated.
Oh, aren't they?
So it's best just to email or call us, and we'll figure out whether it's something we're allowed to do or not.
Okay, okay. And the website is?
www.edenicecider.com.
Great. Well, keep up the great work, and be sure to let us know if you come up with something new. Maybe there's Calvados in your future.
Oh, that would be great.
I love Calvados.
We're hoping we can make enough of a success at Icecider that we can pour all the money into making a Calvados.
I'd like to be able to buy it. I used to cook with it all the time, but it got too pricey.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Albert.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Eleanor, thank you.
Now I feel like I really need a drink, but I guess I'm just going to keep on soldiering on, and we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're back again, and we're moving on to yet another beverage.
Yeah, we're leaving the spirit world and entering a more Zen state of mind.
Yeah, it still would be.
My grandmother was known as a teetotaler, and I'm not sure that the specific origin of that term, but I can kind of guess.
Yeah, but I can kind of guess too. The ladies of the Temperance League who totally drank tea.
Right. So now I drink tea too.
Yeah, you do. Anne drinks a lot of tea. Peter despises tea, as you'll find out in our conversation. But the couple who run this business called Tea Trekkers have so much knowledge to share with us. I learned so much from, and we've had lots and lots of tea guests on before, but it seems that everyone we find something new, and this interview was no exception. So let's hear from the Tea Trekkers.
Now, we have some real tea experts on today. Actually, they're both tea professors or professors of tea and authors, the Tea Enthusiast Handbook, A Guide to the World's Best Teas, also The Story of Tea, A Cultural History and Drinking Guide, which I think was probably the first comprehensive tea book I ever read. We're talking to Mary Lou and Robert Heiss, and you are winners of the James Beard Awards and ISCP Cookbooks Awards, and generally really well respected in this field.
And I thank you for the win, but we were actually nominated. We did not win.
Okay.
I thank you for thinking we did that.
Well, that's all right. I mean,
you probably should have.
Yeah. I think that just you're making it to the final rounds in James Beard when you consider all that goes into these awards. That's a win as far as I'm concerned.
Well, thank you. Many people feel the same way, but we do feel squeamish when we feel we need to actually point out we didn't win.
Well, next time, I mean, it was certainly a big undertaking. Tell me, how did you become tea experts, or what directed you to tea?
Well, we started our shop in Northampton, Massachusetts in 1974, and at that time we started out as a coffee, tea, and spice house, old-fashioned, coming out of the 60s type of establishment, and we had fabulous coffee. The influence was really on coffee in those days, but we did have a fairly significant tea selection. But for those people who are old enough to remember the 70s, the selection of tea available in the 70s was quite limited.
Right.
And the primary reason for that was that China was still closed to outsiders. So it really wasn't until the late 80s and into the 90s that some of the unbelievably famous and special teas from mainland China were then allowed to get out into the marketplace, the worldwide marketplace again, at least in terms of places like the United States, where we were shut off. Now, there were, of course, were other places in the world that dealt with mainland China and had access to those teas, but they were pretty limited because China was pretty shut down for a long time.
But actually, the drinkers themselves were pretty limited. And I don't think you had a very sophisticated audience in the 70s.
That's right. It's probably very similar to the wine industry's influence going from the 60s to the 70s also at the same time, because people really didn't really understand wine that much about 10 years before coffee and tea started to become popular. So it's just been a learning curve. It's been wonderful to have access to some of these historically important and delicious teas that China has had for sometimes hundreds of years, and people on the outside have known about it in certain eras and not known about it in certain eras. And it was really that explosion of available new, quote-unquote, product that really just made tea so much more interesting over the last, say, 15 years. And so we've been involved with that.
Lipton's. No. Let's name this company Tea Trekker, because that, I think, is important for people to know. And it also advances our concept of what we're going to be talking about today.
Yes, thank you. Our shop is Tea Trekker, and the website is teatrekker.com.
And that's TEATREKKER.
Yes, it is.
Great. I think what caught my eye was how many people know that tea is actually seasonal?
I don't think very many. I would like to think that everybody who is in the tea business does know that now, but it's really only since about the year 2000. That's the year that we first went to China, maybe a year or two prior to that, but it's really using the year 2000 as a base. It's really since about the year 2000 that tea buyers from the West, like ourselves, first started to actually go to China and make the discoveries, not discovering a new tea, but make discoveries about how tea really is during the course of the year, what really happens during the manufacture of tea, how it is that green tea is different than black tea. These are kind of vague notions people had prior to about the year 2000, but nobody in the tea business was really traveling to China earlier than that. So once we started to go, and a handful of a few others started to go, we realized this was an extremely complicated system of technique, and it has so many more components about it than I even thought could possibly exist for tea. The notion of seasonality, the notion of specific tea bushes, indigenous tea bushes, bushes that are only found in one part of China and not another, and then you introduce cultural influences within China. You know, some of the areas in the southwest, Yunnan province, for example, where much of the tea is produced by some of the ethnic groups whose descendants and ancestors have controlled some of these giant tea tree forests for generations. These are elements about tea that I don't think anybody in the West really had a big grasp.
Oh, no, it's a whole cultural history, I think.
Yes.
I used to get this, my first exposure to really fine green tea, what came from a very successful orthopedic surgeon from Hong Kong. And I couldn't read the container, although he did tell me what it cost. But he claims that it was picked by monkeys in the mountains.
Oh, that's a story that goes around.
He made it up, didn't he?
I'm not quite sure he made it up in the sense of making it up completely from scratch, but there is that fable out there in Chinese lore, and I'm not quite sure the Chinese ever really meant for us to believe that the tea was picked by monkeys, but I think it underscores the idea of tea that grows in very difficult to reach places where it's hard for people to reach. Therefore, the only creature who could successfully scamper up to these high reaches of the mountains and pick this tea would be monkeys. So I think it's really alliterative and poetic and lovely, but of course
it's not even vaguely real.
Many people do believe it.
Now, when you're talking seasonal, you're talking about, just now you were talking about the fact that the tea crop itself reaches the point where you can pick it seasonally during the year?
Yes. One of the things that's interesting about tea that is basically one of the building blocks of understanding the differences between green tea and oolong tea and black tea is understanding the actual leaf itself that's used for the different types of processes. So in the case of green tea, for instance, in general, you're using either just the buds or the bud and maybe the first and or second leaf that's emerged from the tea bush in the spring when the bush itself has emerged from being dormant over the wintertime.
Okay.
And that's usually referring to the China bush, which is one of the three major subvarieties of Camellia sinensis. Now, a lot of black teas are used for that, or a lot of black teas come from the same, what we call pluck, which is that bud and two leaves. But in the case of oolong tea, for instance, you need a much more mature leaf in order to get the flavor profile that you want for an oolong tea. So the leaves are picked much later in the season, otherwise they wouldn't have the depth of flavor and character that the he needs to have. So throughout the course of the year, you have emerging growth, you have mature growth, you have growth that's gone through the whole cycle of the year and then is picked in the autumn, because in the autumn, basically the leaves have received all of the nutrient and all the flavor that they could possibly absorb, and you want to pluck them before they go dormant in the fall and they start to get woody and lose some of that vibrancy of the current year. And so through the course of the year, you'll have different plucks for different kinds of tea. You'll have different plucks that will have influences on the how the tea flavor exists. And it's just so fascinating because a tea is plucked at a certain time and manufactured at a certain time doesn't mean that that's necessarily the best time to consume it. It just means it's the best time to purchase it and that you need to then pay attention to when the appropriate time is to drink it. So it really can be as complicated or as simple as you want it to be.
Well, how do you know when to drink it?
A lot of it is experience. A lot of it is trying it, and if it tastes wonderful, then okay, drink it up. If it doesn't taste quite so good, then you can let it sit for a month and try it again. We have a wonderful tea right now that's from the Huangshan, which is a range of mountains that runs in central China, and it is one of those teas that has a little bit of a smokiness for the first couple of months that it is, and then it loses that as it rests over time. So people who like that little bit of toasty, smoky character drink it right away, and people who don't like that, let it sit for a couple of months, maybe 2-3 months, and as it rests, basically that just goes away, and then it changes into a totally different type of green tea.
But the tea itself has gone through a drying process, hasn't it, after it's picked?
Absolutely.
After it's picked, it gets dried. Now, do they do anything to make the tea black, or is it just a natural, are they naturally black leaves, and they come from a different plant?
No, that's a good question. No, the plant is all the same type
okay.
of plant in general. There are some sub-variety differences, but what you're picking from the bush is a green plant. Actually, if you can think a little bit of an ivy, not an ivy, but a holly plant. Tea leaves look a little bit like a holly leaf. They're not quite as thick, but they're about that size. They're a little bit shiny and a little bit of a serration. And it's really the manufacture of the leaf. It's what happens in the tea factory. Every time tea is going to be manufactured, there's an intent in mind for what the final tea will be. India, of course, excels in black teas. Japan excels in a different style of green tea, say, than China. And when the tea goes into the factories in Japan to be turned into, say, sencha, a very popular Japanese green tea.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what that is. I guess I want to ask you, why don't I like that?
Well, there could be several reasons. You may be steeping it with water that's too hot. That's a very common situation that some people do. Green tea should have water that's cooler than it is.
Yeah, I do. I have a temperature-controlled kettle, and
okay.
I do 185 Fahrenheit for the green tea.
185?
Yes, that's too.
For the sencha, senchas are more finicky than Chinese greens. You might want to lower your temperature for the sencha and shoot more for about 175.
Okay.
Japanese green tea, if the water is too hot, you'll encourage a bitter edge. If the water is cooler, now, of course, that also means the cup you drink will be cooler. But if the water temperature is cooler for Japanese senchas, you will encourage the innate sweetness. So they're a little bit more finicky. They're always going to be a cooler beverage. And part of why they're different, it's actually a good question that you had about why don't you like them. Part of why they're very different than Chinese teas is even though it comes out of the factory as green tea and the Chinese greens come out of their factories as green tea, there are some different steps in the processing that the Japanese do that the Chinese don't do, which affects the ultimate flavor of the tea. Back to Peter's question about black tea, the tea leaves go into the tea factories in Sri Lanka and India where they're going to come out as black tea. They go in looking just the same as they do going into the factories in China and Japan, but they're using the black tea manufacture, which encourages the leaf to oxidize, which is a natural process of integration with oxygen that will turn the tea leaf black. It's an intentional process by which the leaves darken, turn black. It takes many days to create a black tea, whereas you can have most green teas the same day. So it's a longer, more elaborate process for black tea, the intent of which is for it to come out the other side of the process being dark and having the flavor profile that we associate with those strong dark teas.
Now, you're doing something else around this theme of seasonality, I think, as well. So we talked about the season in the production of tea, but aren't you also thinking about how the different kinds of teas will fit into the drinking season?
Yes.
Did I get that right?
Yes, that's really very fascinating because you can take that to a very serious level, and you can get involved with Asian medicine and cooling teas and warming teas and how the tea actually will affect your metabolism. Or you can just choose by what tea tastes best at a certain time of year. And we tend to prefer going at it from the standpoint of what tastes best certain times of year. So in general, in a temperate climate, which is what we live in Massachusetts, so we're in that temperate zone, so we have a winter and a summer, and we find that green teas and white teas are very refreshing in the summertime, and towards the cooler weather times of the year, we prefer to have a darker tea, say a black tea or a pu'er, and then in the in-between seasons, oolongs are really fabulous because those being semi-oxidized, they give you that really great layering of flavor, and as with the change in the seasons, there's a lot going on, and they're very busy and interesting. Now, conversely, if we lived in someplace that was subtropical, we would probably find that we were drinking pu'er in the really hot and steamy months because people who live there tend to drink those teas then, but it's for a different reason and different cultural history. So it's very fascinating how tea can be drunk different times, different places, for different reasons.
Can you explain, since not everybody's savvy about this, what pu'er actually is?
It's one of the six classes of Chinese tea, green, black, oolong, yellow, white, and pu'er. So it's its own class of tea, hard to compare it to anything else. It's from Yunnan Province, China. It's a very ancient tea. It harkens back to a process of tea making that started about the year 700. And the initial reason for pu'er was to send tea across the border, the northern borders, to some of the Mongols who were trading with the Chinese at that time, and also to send tea to people in Tibet who that part of China had started to trade with. And in order for the tea to make these long trips on horseback or muleback or probably yakback in some cases, you know, up through the Himalaya and up through these, you know, desolate, very, very weather-challenging areas, the tea started to become compressed into some shapes you may have seen. The most common shape of pu'er is pressed into is a round disc. It's called a cake. Or sometimes they're pressed into rectangles or mushroom shapes. But the compression allowed more tea to be stuffed into the saddlebags of these travelers who were going over these very difficult routes. And as the tea gained popularity throughout China, as word of this tea spread from one region to another, it's really been kept up all those years. And the primary interesting fact about pu'er tea, and a lot of people hear this and they think, oh, this sounds awful, but it is really delicious. It's actually a fermented tea.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the fermentation, yeah.
Yes, it's naturally fermented. There are actually microbes alive in the tea leaf that are not killed off by the process of making the tea. You can kill it off later by storing it poorly in your home or in your shop, but if the storage conditions are conducive for the tea, the microbes will live, they'll be happy in there, and what they do over time, you know, say 5 years later from the time that the tea was pressed, 10 years later, it slowly starts to turn the tea into something much richer, much more luxurious, with a much deeper flavor, and it also adds value. In China, people will pay hundreds of dollars for an old tea cake. They can pay over thousands of dollars for a very old tea cake if they're from, say, before 1970. So people in China who are really into pu'er, there's a whole cadre of people who study it, just like people study Burgundy wines. People talk about the vintages. They talk about what tea factory made it. You know, they're very concerned about the storage of it. So there are actually these fermented teas that when they're very young, they can be interesting. When they're slightly older, they can be just utterly delicious, very satisfying and wonderful.
You know, I was assigned a an article about tea, and I started gathering information of it and reading books and so forth and so on, until I finally concluded there was no way I was ever going to be able to write this article.
So she abandoned the project. But listeners, for those of you who are fascinated and want more, I'm sure there's a positive wealth of information on the Tea Trekkers website, and maybe you even have a newsletter or people can ask you questions.
Yes, the website has a lot of information because ever since the New York Times dubbed us the professors of tea, we have just really excelled at trying to give people information so they can enjoy tea more. It's the reason we wrote the big book, The Story of Tea, and we're just so excited to have people learn more and more about tea all the time. So we're adding to the website all the time with new information, and we think it's a great resource.
And readers can go to the site and sign up for our electronic newsletter, which we call the e-zine. We send that out about once a month.
Okay.
And we announce new teas for folks.
And you can buy
area.
Teas right over from your website.
Yes, you can.
Yes.
Okay.
We give classes, so we announce classes. So the e-zines are nice. We don't send them out too frequently, but people seem to enjoy them.
Well, we've been excited about having you on the program. It's hard to imagine that a cup of tea could be so exciting. This is an Englishman who grew up hating tea.
Because, oh, no!
Because it was always so evil, thick and brown, and had milk and sugar in it. So you are to be congratulated for making the world of tea more accessible and providing us with some very interesting conversation today. And thank you so much. Oh, Anne has a final question.
One final question is, okay. I have been conscientiously drinking a minimum of 2 cups of green tea every single day. Am I wasting my time, diverting my attention from other teas? Is green tea that much healthier than other teas?
I don't really think it's been proven whether it is or not. You know, because of the fact that all tea comes from the same plant, give or take little differences for the tea bush varieties, it essentially all comes from the same fresh leaf, to look at it that way. So what happens to it within the tea factory changes a little bit of the internal chemistry of the leaf, but researchers are now looking at black tea, and green tea has one set of antioxidants, one set of tea catechins. Black tea, which has changed internally because of the different processing it undergoes, has a different set of tea catechins. So researchers are starting to think that black tea is at least as healthy and good for one as green tea. It may actually, in the long run, be better. So what we always tell our customers who ask these kind of questions is that, you know, from our simplistic looking at all of the information that we've ever been presented about the health benefits of tea, there's really no reason to think one class of tea has more of it than the other. So you should drink whatever you enjoy,
okay,
so that you enjoy that cup and you're not looking at it like a medicine, like something that's, you know, going to...
I like it well enough.
I don't like the taste of.
Right. I like it.
And if you want to cover all the bases, you can always mix it with red wine and get both benefits at the same time.
Indeed. That may be the next kind of tea down the pike.
And having said that, it's obviously time for us to say goodbye.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. We love talking about tea.
So let's take another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and the next section of the program, the very last part, brings with it a warning from the censor. The background noise of all those Clevelanders at Five Star Sensation is pretty loud on these two tracks. They're two excellent interviews with Joe Miller of Joe's in Venice, and the chef from a wonderful new burger and shake restaurant in Las Vegas called Holstein Las Vegas.
Oh, boy, did I pig out on those pork rinds?
Yes, you pigged out on the pork rinds, and you pigged out on the potato chips.
The potato chips they were so good. They were really...
And Joe's...
He called it lard. He called it something else.
Yeah, is that right? Okay.
They were fried in.
And Joe Miller's an amazing participant in the foundation and growth of California cuisine, having been in Venice, California for 20 years. So hang with these interviews if you can, because I think you'll find them very interesting, although they are, as I mentioned at the beginning of this segment, they are a little loud in the background.
sometimes you hear about a restaurant for a long time before you ever meet the person responsible for it. And tonight we have met Joe Miller of Joe's Restaurant in Venice, California. Nice to meet you, Joe.
Hello, it's nice to meet you.
Now, you've been at this a long time.
I have.
You look very young, but you've been at it a long time.
Well, thank you. It must be the California sunshine.
Your restaurant is always referred to as like the California restaurant. You do Cal French, is it?
Yes, yes. We've been there for 20 years now, and we've been doing the same cuisine, evolving with the time, of course.
But you've also been, you were like one of the first ones to line up with the farm-to-table stuff.
Well, yes, we have been shopping the farmers markets ever since we did open, and we were small enough to have the farmers support what we did at Joe's.
And you were involved with the Santa Monica farmers market, right?
Exactly, exactly. We've even expanded that, where we have a little grade school across the street from us, and they have raised some money and gotten a couple of grants and have a great garden there, which we actually have them plant different vegetables and herbs for us, and then I go across the street and exchange and teach the fifth grade class how to cook the vegetables in the garden.
I mean, that's the ideal situation.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. You walk across the street and harvest the vegetables.
I love it. Now, you're written about as a visionary in the kitchen. What does that mean? Everybody does funny things now in the kitchen.
Yes, no, it's true. But I think with my chef, Chris and Greg, who helped me create the food and the menu on a nightly basis, we sort of blend the technique that I've learned and have grown up with their new ideas being young chefs coming up in the rank.
Are they all doing that, young chefs? They're looking at the kitchen science now, everybody coming up.
Looking at kitchen science and just new combinations of flavor, new plating prep presentations is also a very big change of how food has evolved.
But you're very laid back. You probably welcome all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have our ways that we like to stick with and know that work, and then we have to look at what's new and see where it's going and try to give our guests what's new and up and coming.
Now, is this your first time here?
Yes, this is my first time in Cleveland, Ohio at this event.
Is this event wonderful?
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is. I've done the American Food and Wine Festival back in L.A. with Wolfgang.
With Wolfgang.
And
he said this one runs better, actually. Oh, I should have brought it.
Yes, no. He and I was gracious enough, or he was great gracious enough to invite me to come to this event this year.
Well, I mean, I think we go to all these things, you know, and I think this was really rather special.
Yes, I think it is.
I have not tasted. Peter did. What are you serving up tonight? Tell me the what it is. Go get some, but tell me what I have.
Please do. I think we've been told it was one of the favorite items beneath the tent. The first dish we have is a spice seared Spanish mackerel, of which we grill it on the skin side only so it gets a little crisp. We serve that with a black lentil puree, a garlic mint yogurt, pickled watermelon rind, and a little cilantro flower as a garnish.
Oh, shoot, I'd love to go get some.
There's a lot going on that dish, but it's a very, very composed, beautiful dish that Chris came up with. And it's just an absolute fabulous dish. Our second dish we have is a cavatelli, which is a handmade pasta, fresh, with a corn sauce, and served with a smoked oxtail. We take oxtail, we smoke it, and then we braise it for 6 hours till it falls off the bone, and then serve that with a little hazelnut breadcrumb.
Well, I'm going to have it.
Yes, you'll have to come by and have it.
Website for the restaurant.
Yes, our website is joe@joesrestaurant.com. And you will see, or just Joe's, excuse me, that's our email address. Our website is just joesrestaurant.com, and you'll see all the fun things that we do there and how the place looks. And if you're in L.A., please come out and see us in Venice. Nice to be here, and come out and see us this year, especially because it's our 20th anniversary, and we're still going strong.
Anthony Meidenbauer, may I call you Tony, since everybody does?
Absolutely.
Great. Well, thank you for talking about the menu.
No problem.
Your operation is a little bit complicated, but certainly is delicious. The first thing I went for when we walked into this event tonight, potato chips and,
yes,
your pork rinds of all things.
Yep.
Tell me exactly what Holstein's Shakes and Buns is.
Basically, we're an American gastropub burger joint that emphasizes on fresh-made, delicious ingredients. We're mainly burgers and shakes.
You're absolutely totally in Las Vegas, right?
Yes. So we're burgers and shakes. We have about 20 different burgers and about 30 different shakes with and without alcohol. We have a great pastry chef making a lot of our ice creams fresh in-house, grinding our meats fresh in-house, bringing in beautiful artisanal cheeses from Northern California and all across the country. Amazing produce to put out some really, really great fruit at a very affordable price for Las Vegas.
Yeah, that would be something.
Yes.
Actually, it used to be very cheap in Las Vegas.
It did. The days of the 99-cent
really
shrimp cocktail and the cheap buffets is long gone. It's a different time,
yeah,
which is really exciting. Some great chefs, great talent in Las Vegas right now, and we're excited to be a part of it.
How did you end up there? Where are you from?
I am from upstate New York, not too far from here in Buffalo, New York, or Niagara Falls area. Absolutely, right up the 90 from here. So I've been in Cleveland many times, just like being at home. The same
it's very
exact
similar,
weather.
Isn't
yeah, it's
it?
Very similar. Nice and green and beautiful and great people, great personalities, and it's great to be here in Cleveland.
Now, how did you end up doing food, and how did you end up in Vegas?
Well, I've had family in Vegas since I was a little kid. My great-grandparents lived out there. They retired from Pennsylvania to Las Vegas, so I've been going for my whole life. And I've seen it go from a desolate desert to this huge, sprawling metropolis that it is now. And when I was a kid, all I liked to do was cook, so it was the only career that I ever wanted to really do was be a chef.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, I really love it. You gotta love it to do this crazy job.
Why would you love it so much?
I don't know. I think growing up as a kid with my family, my parents, my grandparents always cooked. So growing up, you always want to help and be involved, and then you want to kind of do stuff on your own. Practice with the stuff in the scene, and then it just seemed like a natural career. I really liked doing it. I tried a few other things, and it wasn't for me.
There you are. And successful. Now, how did you end up at Five Star Sensation? Is this your first
time?
This
is our first year.
What do you think?
It's amazing. It's a great festival.
It's
great
one of the
time.
Best we've ever
people
been
are amazing. The amount of money they raise for this, the cause for the Seidman Center, the University Hospitals to fight cancer. You know, everyone's touched or has known someone that's been affected by the disease. So it's a great opportunity to raise money. In awareness.
$11 million or something they raised.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Really
$12 million in the last 24 years.
$12 million.
They're almost at $2 million this year, which is amazing. They've been doing this for, this is the 12th event. Every 2 years they do it. It's the first time we've been here. We've done other events with Wolfgang Puck, so he's invited us to come out here.
Okay. So
it's, it's the first time
Wolfgang
to come do this, but hopefully it's not the last.
He's amazing, isn't he?
He is amazing. It's really great.
Well, I mean, he's so mobbed. I don't think we're going to get to interview him right now, but we kind of interview him regularly, and
right.
He's an amazing person.
He is amazing. Very philanthropic. Does a lot of stuff for not only his community, but other communities, which is amazing.
Now, we've heard this rumor that one of the reasons people like on coming back is because you chefs party hardy while you're here. Is there any truth to that rumor?
I don't know nothing about that. I definitely love Cleveland. If I had time, I'd run up to Cedar Point and go on some roller coasters. But we're back in Vegas tomorrow, so unfortunately, hopefully come back in a couple of years and do it again.
Yeah, it's every 2 years.
Yes.
But I think that's probably the right pace.
Yes.
How to find your restaurant?
You can find us at holsteinslv.com, or you can go to the hotel, the cosmopolitanlasvegas.com website, and you can find out all information about us as well as the amazing property that we're located in Las Vegas.
Oh, you sound really cool.
Yes, it's a gorgeous property, easy to get in, a lot of amazing restaurants and beautiful lounges and bars and retail. It's a great place to go and hang out. Amazing pool right on the strip, so it's a beautiful property. Well, we're happy to be a part of it.
You're creating a lot of buzz here, so I'm going to have to let you get back to your station because everybody's all stopping by there. And I would have died if I wasn't able to walk in to get those advantages right away.
We would have saved some for you. We knew you wanted them.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for talking with me.
Bye. I just thought of a great...
Oh, you just thought of a great something.
A great term for what we were presenting.
Go ahead.
It's audibly challenging.
Audibly challenging, huh? Well, we hope you were audibly challenged, but found the whole program to be interesting, and you'll join us again. Same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.